Hello and welcome to the first episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. I'm your host Arzu, a cancer survivor as well as cancer champion for the patient-led charity The Yorkshire Cancer Community. I am also part of the Cancer Smart initiative, which is an exciting opportunity to help tackle cancer and its associated inequalities in West Yorkshire and Harrogate. In particular, we're looking at how we can help improve outcomes of all cancer patients through early diagnosis and screening and provision of preventative advice. Today, I'm very excited to have an inspirational guest on our podcast, and someone I've only really gotten to know this past year, but I have to really commend their contribution to raising awareness about cancer and contributing to the cancer care that is offered to patients. He's also a fellow cancer champion and cancer survivor, Rob. So thank you so much for joining me today, Rob. I'm so excited to speak to you and hear your cancer survival story.
Hi, Azu. That's quite an introduction. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. It's good to be here, and I'm really pleased that we are doing this. It's something that we've talked about, and I know it's something that you've driven tirelessly to get to the point we're at now, and I'm also very proud to be your guest today and happy to talk about everything.
Thank you. And would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners today and tell them a bit more about you?
Okay, so I'm Rob. I'm as you say, a cancer survivor. I had head and neck cancer, which was localised to the vocal cord, right vocal cord, which was diagnosed in the January of 2018. So I'm 3 years out of treatment, 3 years,
wow.
I suppose, without incident. And I spend a lot of time now, as you say, trying to raise awareness, changing the story or changing the journey for people as they go along. I live in West Yorkshire, been here for quite a while now, since 2006. Enjoy my motorcycles. My work is in construction. I quite enjoy that. I do project management. I keep fairly local if I can. Just normal person that you'd probably walk past in the street, and someone that is quite keen to make sure that the one in two that everyone professes to be affected by cancer have a bit of an easier journey and possibly an earlier diagnosis, which would be
absolutely
the goal we're in for.
Yep. Definitely. And, you said that you're just a regular person from West Yorkshire, but truly inspirational. And I'm just so excited for you to share your entire story today on the episode and hopefully inspire other people like myself as well. Without further ado, Rob, I really, want you to tell us a bit more about your story and how it all started.
Okay. So, I worked, as I say, in construction, quite a hectic sort of area, chaotic sort of working life at the time. And in 2017, I went quite a long period of that time losing my voice. I mean, my voice would go, it would completely vanish, it would be croaky, it would be weak. And I'd find any excuse that I possibly could to not go to the doctors to get it checked out. It'd be stress, it'd be too much coffee, dust, you name it, I would find a different reason for it, regardless of people telling me you sort of need to get that looked at. And it sort of came to a head at Christmas of 2017. And we spent some time in Christmas Day with friends, family, and had been down to see my family on Christmas Day. Which was a bit of a journey. It's down in Oxfordshire, so it was there and back in a day.
Right.
Got home, we were going to go somewhere else, and I was going to go to some friends and spend the evening there and the night there. And I just wanted to go home. I'd just literally worn out. I didn't feel right at all, and it wasn't like me to feel ill. My partner said, look, you need to go to the doctors. And
yeah,
it was just sort of kick that I needed, that I thought, right, fine, you know, if I'm going to ring the doctors then. And I did. And I rang the doctor. Obviously, the next day was Boxing Day. So I rang them on the 27th, fully expecting them to be shut. And they weren't. And I was in the next day. So the 28th, I went in to the doctors. And his words, pretty much, you remember this. These are things that you can forget, all sorts, but you'll remember these. And it was, I don't think it's laryngitis, because I thought, oh, it's just an infection, it's just stress, it's just dust. And he went, no, it's a bit more than that. And obviously the GPs can't do as in-depth look, yeah, especially in the throat area.
Absolutely.
So he said, we need to get you into a consultant. And I thought, well, yeah, fair enough. That'll take about 2 months to get sorted. I can sort of brush it off again.
Mm.
The week later, I was in Halifax with Mr. Arambe, consultant, head, right, consultant there. So I didn't hang around. It was the 4th of January I was there. And I, not wanting to be too brutal, but they put a small camera up your nose and down your throat. And I've had it over a dozen times now, more. And yeah, you still never get used to it, but there you go. But it was a case of the camera went down, and his words were, in 25 years, I can tell you that that's a tumour. And that was it. I was like, right, okay, fair enough.
Mm.
What do we do now? And he said, well, obviously, you know, you need to biopsy, but and that sort of stuff. But it was that point where you sort of know, you know, in the back of your mind, you know, or I knew that that's what it was. You don't get to that point and have it for that long without it being an issue or something a bit more. So he said, look, we need to do a biopsy and everything else. You pop you in, do a check, you've been in and out, everything else. And that was the next stage, really.
Yeah.
So and I thought, well, that's going to take a bit of time and all this sort of stuff. And, 10 days later, 15th of Jan, bang, straight into Halifax again, day patient. Right. And you go in, so my partner Sarah took me over, dropped me off. You bring your dressing gown and your pyjamas and all that, and you stand there and wait. In you go. Partner goes off, has a cup of tea, cup of coffee, comes back, picks you up, takes you home. No, it was 10 o'clock I went in, and instead of waking up at 10:45 and going round and on my way home at 11, I woke up at 2:30 in the afternoon in recovery. So right, I was in there for 4.5 hours.
Wow.
Which resulted in a five-day stay in hospital. Mm-hmm. This was a Monday.
Right.
And I ended up staying in for 5 days. So basically what
happened... Was this after your biopsy?
So the biopsy time I was in was for 4.5 hours, right, not just 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And what happened was, through that 10 days between seeing the consultant and after, it grew to about 50 mil.
All right.
So there was a 50 mil tumour.
Yeah.
In my throat, on my vocal cords. And what was happening was it was restricting breathing. So you'd wake up at night, obviously choking, you couldn't breathe, you were struggling to do, walk to the shop. I was an active person. I run half marathons, played sport, went to the gym, did this, did that, rode motorbikes, climbed hills, everything. And this corner shop, pint the milk, it's honestly a 2 minute walk, and I was struggling to walk it, and it had grown quite a bit, so they had to sort of debulk it. And during the debulking, that took so many hours during the debulking, that just took So it's a long time to reduce the size without doing damage. Because one of the things that Mr. Arabi said to me was, what is the worst thing? What do you not want to happen? You know, what is the worst thing for you that could happen? And I just said, look, if you're going to have to, you have it in your mind of what they're going to do. And you always think the worst case scenario. For me, it was that stoma, that, you know, the hole, and people holding the microphones and stuff to the throat. And I just thought, I just don't want that. I'm not having that. Mm-hmm. You know, I was 51, you know.
I
wasn't old. And I thought, if it's going to be like that, I don't want it. I don't, just don't bother. I just roll with it as it goes and go from there. And he took that on board. And the problem came getting tubes down and everything else. They couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So to do that, he had to try and debulk it and everything else, and it took a long time. And even now, I mean, I haven't seen him for a while because he's not been so well himself, but every time I see him, I always thank him for not cutting it out, because I've kept a voice, a normal voice.
Exactly.
And he sort of built around that, and as a result of that, there was a lot of tissue damage, shall we say, with what they debulked. Now, the next day, I mean, they kept me in, and I was obviously a bit apprehensive. I mean, the last time I was in hospital, or for the time before that, was 1972.
Wow. So you've been pretty lucky. Pretty lucky, your life.
Pretty much. I mean, apart from breaks, dislocations and sprains.
Right.
From the rugby pitch or from cricket and stuff like that, I'd never stayed in hospital.
Wow.
And I had my tonsils, I was six, which they used to do is just, that was it, six, tonsils had noise, out. And that was a day patient, but they went wrong and they did some damage inside and I ended up staying overnight.
Right.
So I'd never really stayed in hospital until this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're getting the best of care and everything's great, but you're obviously thinking, I've just had a biopsy, what's going to happen?
But absolutely.
You're right, it's there. I mean, you know what that's like. And, you know, it's not the best of times. But physically, I felt great because I just had 50 mil of tumour removed from an orifice that's probably about 55 mil in diameter. So I was like, great. I was up and downstairs, I was walking around, nipping down for coffee, getting caught, getting told off, getting sent back to the ward. So I was doing quite well. And then came Thursday, and that's the day that they came and said to me, go a minute, come here, a little chat. You know what they've come for. You know, we both been there. You know why they're there. They're not coming, you know. So they came armed with some paper and took me into a room. And I was always a bit sort of upset about the process and how it was done rather than what the news was. And this will come to light later, where it's more a case of that's what drives me now, is that process for people, because people are still told sometimes in quite an inhumane way. If that might seem a bit extreme, but their dignity and humanity and their feelings are not, you know, okay, you can't feather it, you can't fluff it up and everything else. You have cancer, or you have a tumour, you have this. It's those words are the ones that you just go, and nothing else around you matters at that time.
Absolutely.
And you've been there. And it's, they can tell you what they want, but you've just heard the words and that's all you hear. Cancer, I'm going to die.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And that's so, but it's getting, so that was it. But I was a little bit disappointed because I wasn't really given the opportunity to have someone with me. I wasn't really told anything other than it's a sacral cell carcinoma and it's stage three and it's there, and pretty much we'll be in touch.
And like in terms of, when you did receive a diagnosis, did they sort of disclose anything beforehand to help you prepare mentally for what was coming? Or would you say it was very abrupt?
Have you got a minute?
Okay.
Can we have a word? And right. They took me to a room which was opposite the ward, the side ward I was in, which was a single room.
Right.
And the poor fellow who was in it for a couple of days that I'd been there had sadly passed away the night before.
Right. Right.
And they used that room because they just cleaned it. So I was like, yeah. So no, there was no, we'll come and see you at 11 or 3 or mm-hmm. whatever. Do you want to call someone? It was, have you got a minute? Can we have a word?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Oh, right. Okay. And I probably couldn't have got someone there because it was a Thursday, you know, morning. But it was done. And on reflection, I'm sort of still either or, because it could have been done a little bit more differently. But
absolutely.
What are you going to say? You know, what could they possibly say? So that was it, really. And all I wanted to do at that point was go home. Can I go home?
Yeah.
and then went, well, you know, and the next day, Friday, I went home. And it starts to sink in, you know. And, you got to tell people you work with, and you know, time of work, make arrangements, what you do, find out, and you're in that limbo, you know, and there isn't anything to do, and you don't know what's happening, and you don't know what's going off, and you're waiting. So I decided that I was going to be as physically active and fit and, you know, strong as possible. And I was feeling pretty good physically, because like I said, that whole tumour, pretty much, not all of it, but 90% of it had been removed.
Yeah.
So I was feeling great, off for walks, doing this, doing that. And I went for a walk a couple of weeks later. I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and walk to the next village, which is 2 miles, and it's uphill and downhill on a bus route. So I thought, I can walk there, and if I don't feel right, I get on the bus. Come on. I walk to this pub.
Yeah.
I know it's there, does nice lunches. Mm-hmm. Have a sandwich, a cup of tea, get on the bus, come home. Something to do. Take my mind off it. Pub was shut. We were lucky there. End of January, pub was shut. So I couldn't have a sandwich. So I thought, well, what do I do? So I looked at the bus stop, which is next to the pub, looked at the timetable. 40-minute wait for a bus. I'm going for a walk. So I went for a walk. So I went further and further and further. And it got later and later and later, and the temperature dropped, and it got cold because it was the end of January.
Right.
And Saturday I didn't feel right. Sunday I could hardly breathe. Monday I'm ringing CNS up saying, don't feel right. And they went, you don't sound right. And I'd picked up an infection, and I was back in hospital for a week, at which Mr. Arabi wasn't very happy because I'd put myself at risk and all this sort of stuff.
Mm.
But it was the way I say it was because I was determined to sort of not give in, if you see what I mean. I was not going to sit there and go, this is what I'm doing. I was more a case of, right, I'm going to face this head on, and I'm going to do it my way and exercise. And at the time, exercise wasn't really something that they wanted you to do. They wanted you to just, where now exercise is one of the main things they want you to do,
absolutely,
to focus your mind. Yeah, you know, focus your body.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, like, as people just going through cancer, when you're just newly diagnosed, you do tend to think that you're invincible, and you somewhat do not want to accept the fact that you have cancer. And just to prove to yourself that nothing's wrong, you know, you want to push yourself to certain extents that a normal person, for example, wouldn't. And I think you walking up that hill, or, you know, wanting to exercise and get out and do what you would normally do, is just a sign of your willpower and the fact that you just don't want to give up on who you truly were. But also something I feel like a lot of people who get diagnosed both during treatment and after treatment feel, that, you know, they don't want to give in, like you said, they don't want to be you know, victim to their cancer, or accept defeat. They want to fight back immediately. And I think that's a bit of a reaction that you immediately have when you receive such a news. So, you know, I can completely sort of relate to how you reacted and responded to the whole situation.
No, you're right.
Even though doctors, for example, you know, from the medical perspective would be like, you know, this isn't the right thing, but I completely, you know, can understand why you acted in a certain way and what your thought process was behind this. So
I agree. I mean, the doctors did say, no, you can't do this. It's like you've got to just take it easy. You've got to prepare. You've got to do this. And I was like, nope, gym, right. I want a membership. Can I have a personal trainer? Can I do this? And yeah, I did do too much. There were days when I was on the floor or I didn't feel, I wasn't really, I did a little too much. And I always remember there was like the manager there. I basically went to him. I said, look, this is the situation. This is what's wrong with me. I'm about to enter into chemotherapy and radiotherapy, but I wanted to do it. And they knew. And then I'd had a couple of sort of overdone it. And when I was in treatment, I was still going. And the trainer that I was using was away. And I used another one. And they all knew. But this guy, I wasn't quite prepared for having to sort of help me down onto the floor because I was ready to pass out because I'd just overdone it. And I'd never told my CNS or Matt Millen or anyone that I was dealing with. They said, are you still going to the gym? And I said, yeah, I could now and again. I do this, do that. How's it going? Oh, just gentle. And actually, I was pushing myself to the extreme, as you rightly say, because there was no way I was going to allow this to win. I mean, I used to go to treatment. I was telling Jill the other day, Jill was asking me, I used to go, I mean, you know, chemotherapy and radiotherapy is horrendous. And it takes a long time to recover. And I was fine. I was fine until midway through and I had the second big chemo. And it absolutely knocked me to the ground. I mean, I fell over in boots in the lead station. And I couldn't get up. I physically couldn't get up. And that shook me up. Because, I mean, I'm not old. I'm not. You know, I'm a normal person.
Yeah.
I'm fit, healthy, and I'd fell over and I couldn't physically get myself up. Mm-hmm. And nobody helped me. Nobody said, not even the people in boots helped me. They were more concerned that I'd knocked more stuff over because I couldn't. And it was narrow aisles in there. But anyway, after then, they said, oh, I was telling one of the nurses afterwards, I said, really upset, because they said, you're all right, and I was a bit embarrassed, and I was a bit upset about the fact that. And they said, well, you need to get yourself something to help you walking around with, you know. And I'm going, there's no way I'm having a walking stick or a crutch. So I used to carry an umbrella. So I went and bought an umbrella, a proper gentleman's type umbrella to walk with. And regardless of whether it was raining or a chance, there could not be a cloud in the sky, and I would go to Jimmy's with my umbrella. And I'd rather people think I was eccentric or strange than weak. And that was when the ladies on reception used to see me standing there like a guard in the palace with his umbrella waiting, and they were going, expecting rain. And I used to go, no, but I won't be falling over today. Because I'd got that there that I needed, and it was that sort of stuff that just kept me going. I mean, I wouldn't give in at any point. I mean, I spoke to my partner and I said, I need to do this myself. I used to go every day on my own, get myself there. I couldn't drive because the steroids and stuff like that. They are trippy. I mean.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, being a child of the 90s, I shouldn't say anything like that, but I was a bit, I couldn't physically drive because of the tablets and stuff like that. So I used to get a bus, and I used to get a train, and I used to get a taxi, and go to Jimmy's, and I'd walk, and I'd do this, and I'd do that. And I used to go to Lanes in Leeds and have eggs on toast, poached eggs on sourdough toast. Probably the worst thing you could eat is sourdough toast when you're having radiotherapy on your throat. But I did it every day, and that was just because I could go in and do that. And the dietitian used to go, speech therapist would go, have you If you tell us the day, I go, yep, absolutely. But because you're there every day.
And I think that can give you that sense of control over your life, because when you're diagnosed with cancer, you know, treatment, whether it's chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery, we don't get to choose what happens to our body. We don't get to choose how that drug's going to affect us. It affects both us, you know, physically and mentally, you know, psychologically. It's such an exhausting process. And so it's these little things in our life, you know, things like what we eat or what we do that gives us that sense of control. And I mean, during my treatment, I was so guilty of not following my physiotherapist instructions. Like, I got a list of exercises to do and I was so exhausted from the chemotherapy that I was like, you know what, I'm not doing this. Or I had a math tutor on the ward, and every time she'd come to make me do some algebra, I just said to my mom, tell them that I'm asleep, I'm not well, I'm not doing any math while I'm having chemotherapy. So it's just that little bit of control that I sense from this little thing. So I can really, you know, understand why you wanted to go to the gym or why you wanted to eat, you know, a certain food, because it's not giving in to that cancer really at the end of the day, not sort of giving up on yourself because of a diagnosis, because you're more than that diagnosis. You're, you know, you're Rob or I'm Azu at the end of the day, and you don't want to lose yourself.
Exactly. I mean, I understand so clearly what you're saying, and you're right, that is what it was. It was, this is my way of dealing with that problem. I mean, I remember, I mean, like I say, it was, I'd never been stayed in hospital since I was, well, at any point in my adult life. I was 6 years old one night. I mean, all I wanted was the ice cream and go home. And it was a case of, what the hell's happening now? I could easily have just collapsed and let it all overwhelm, but that wasn't what was going to happen. And there was one night, and I just had all this stuff from Matt Miller, and it was one of the things was that they just give you books, you get books and books and books to read, and you don't read them, you don't, you just look at them and you start seeing side effects, and they have to tell you all the worst side effects of what can possibly happen, what's probably happened to one person. You read it and you're thinking, what's going to happen to me? Is this going to happen to me? And then I was just so at a loss that night. And I wasn't sleeping because it was when I was in hospital the second time. So after I got that infection, I was in there and it started to hit home, and the drugs were kicking in and stuff. And the thing that we were saying was, no one should face cancer alone.
Yeah.
And I was just like, that's rubbish. You do. At 3 o'clock in the morning, when you're staring at the ceiling, thinking, what is going to happen? You are alone. No matter how many books you get, how many people go, put you whatever you need, you are on your own.
Yeah.
And that's when I was thinking, it's got to be better than this. There's got to be some way that you can open this to, you know, it was something that I wanted to focus on. And I started to write about every day and what happened. And it didn't matter whether it was good or bad. One of the things I wanted to do was write a book all my life. And I thought, what better opportunity than when you start waiting for your radiotherapy to start writing? And the nurse said, why don't you write, instead of write this story that you're thinking of, write this story now. And that's what I did. I mean, it were 45, 50,000 words about
what
was going on. And there was a spell in it where I wrote something like 4 or 5 a day, because I was just, it was at the end of treatment. And you know, at the end, it's just, you're just like, no, fatigue, they call it. Fatigue. And it's like, yeah, and I've been tired and I thought I was fatigued and worn out. Oh, no, fatigue is, they give you levels, don't they? Remember, 1 to 4. I think I was like the second one up. I can't remember which way around it went, but I was like, oh my God, if it gets worse than this. Matt Millen have changed it now. McMillan changed it from no one should face cancer alone to we should face it together or stand it together or whatever else.
Absolutely.
Because it probably wasn't just me, but I think a lot of people probably went, yeah, you do, you are, you know, without any doubt. But it moved on. But as you know,
this reminds me of that ad. I think it's for Macmillan Cancer Support, where they show that person in the ice cold all on his own dealing with that diagnosis. And whenever I look at that, like even on the billboards, you have that picture, I truly feel those emotions and that coldness that comes with the diagnosis and that sense of loneliness, even though there's so many people around you. So, you know, I completely can relate to that aspect of how you were feeling, and like writing really helped you get through that aspect of treatment, I'd say, as well.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it was something that I could focus, you know, where you didn't, you know, you'd think, well, do I tell people that? Do I want to burden my partner with that? Do I want to upset her even more? Do I want to upset my family even more? So you try and hold some of it in or some of it back, and probably wrongly, you know, probably incorrectly. Well, it is incorrect because they're there to support, but we each have our own way of dealing with it.
Absolutely.
And mine was to take it on head on my own and deal with it, and it won't win in, and I was pursuing, and it did nearly win a couple of times. It did knock me on the floor a couple of times, but I kept getting back up and I kept cracking on. But I when I started treatment, there's certain things that you have to go through with head and neck, and there's some days that really knock it in, and there's one where you go to Jimmy's and you spend all day there and they fit you with a mask, and that's the day of realisation. And the mask is a sheet of plastic with holes in it. Have you ever seen one?
No, I'm hearing about this for the first time. So,
right, well, I'll show you a picture one day of what it'll look like. But basically, it's a sheet of plastic. And you lay in this frame, and they lay this plastic over your face, and it's all warm and heated up, and it molds around your head to sort of the top of your chest and your shoulders.
Right.
And then they cut a hole in it for your mouth and your nose so you can breathe. And then they put a tattoo on your chest. On your chest. So I got three NHS tattoos.
What?
They're basically to line the lasers up so it knows where to put the treatment, the radiation.
Right.
Because
I didn't have radiotherapy, so I'm not really familiar with how it all works, especially with the head and neck region. Wow.
Yeah, so
that sounds scary.
It's that day where you think, oh, right, this is really happening now.
Yeah. And like, how did you deal with, you know, having to go in for treatment, you know, radiotherapy being so new to everything? I mean, I obviously didn't know anything about how cancer treatment works. So like, what was it like for you going into something like that?
It's hard to sort of describe it. It's dramatic in a way. It's a challenge, and it's a viewpoint of how you look at it. I mean, it's you don't know what's going to happen. You can read it, and it says you're going to get this and get that, and they're going to do this and they're going to do that. But the reality of it is, you sit there and you think that first day, and you're like, "Is this going to hurt? Is this going to be uncomfortable? Is this going to be?" And in the truth, when you have radiotherapy, for me, it didn't hurt.
Right.
Okay. You are locked in this frame. You're not allowed to move. The biggest problem I ever had was the music was appalling. So you go in and they put some music on for you because you've been there for 20 to 30 minutes. I mean, it's not like a zap go. You're in this tube, in this frame. You lay on this bed and you're strapped in and they play some music. And obviously all the medical staff leave the room. You give a little button if it's a problem, because this whole massive machine goes over your head, round you, and through you, and round you, and it can be quite claustrophobic or uncomfortable. And towards the end of treatment, it was very difficult to do physically because of the damage of, I mean, I had 35 infections.
I went
for 7 weeks, 5 days a week. In fact, it was longer because I got Good Friday off. Good Friday that year was my birthday. So I got the Friday off, but I had to go in Easter Saturday. Right. So it went into like 7.5 weeks.
And like just looking back, you know, having to go through such aggressive treatments, you know, when you think about your whole cancer journey, you know, is there a reason why you delayed going to, you know, seek medical help and speak to your GP about that sore throat or the, you know, symptoms that you were getting? And having seen your entire journey, do you think that you would have done something differently now that you've learned through the actual experience?
Yeah, I'd have gone to the doctors. If I'd gone to the doctors, if I hadn't been...
stubborn.
Yeah. If I hadn't been a typical bloke going, that wrong with me. I'm all right. It's now, when in the back of your mind, you know it is. And I don't, I'm probably incorrect saying I'm a typical bloke. It's, I wasn't, and I'm not. And I'm just a normal person who, whatever your gender is, whoever you are, wherever you're from, 90% of us will not go to the doctors.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why one of the things that we're talking about at the cancer community and the Alliance of Macmillan is opening it up to ethnic minorities and focusing on them people to come in as well. Because everyone does it. No one goes to the doctors. And I can honestly say, if I'd gone to the doctors 6 months earlier, I probably wouldn't have had radiotherapy.
Right.
I'd have had an operation and that would have been it. And it would have probably been all right.
Yeah.
I left it and I almost left it too late. And at the end of that treatment, it was probably the worst 3 months of my life because I ended up 2 weeks in hospital nearly at the end. I got to the penultimate day. So I was on zapping 34, sat there going, I got one more day to go. I got, come here one more day. I'm done.
Yeah.
I can ring that bell and I can go home. And I never did ring that bell, by the way, because for me, I had a change of heart. But anyway, I got there one day to go and they kept me in. And I went, you can't swallow. You're having real problems with fluid. You need to sort out, you're losing a lot of weight. I mean, I lost nearly a stone in a week at one point.
Wow.
And
they're
just like, you're staying in. One of the things they offer you at the start, let's say they do the mask, they check your teeth. I mean, there were guys there with no teeth. I kept my teeth because my teeth were in good order. I lost a crown. They took a crown out, which I was a little bit aggrieved about because I'd just paid for it. So it was an old one that obviously they didn't last so long. They replaced it. Paid my dentist to put this crown in. I got diagnosed 6 months later and they went, we're taking that crown out because that crown's done, but the rest of your teeth stay. There were guys with no teeth. They were dribbling everywhere. There were a lot of problems with treatment in that head and neck area. One of the other things was a tube and they're going to put a tube inside you. So they cut a hole and you put a tube through, a feeding tube. And I went, I'm not having that. I'm not having that tube because all that's going to do is give you the opportunity to put me on liquid food. I wouldn't do it. And at the end, I had to have it. And if it's not, and at the time, they won't operate and put it in. So I had to go in the only other way it could do. And it went up my nose and down into my stomach. And it never worked. And it's liquid food. It was horrendous. And I couldn't drink. I wasn't allowed to drink anything, water, nothing. I had fluids intravenously. And they said to me, are you all right? And I went, not really. No, you've got a lot of morphine. I said, do you want a lollipop? And I went, yeah, okay, I'll have a lollipop. And I thought, a lollipop, that'd be ace. A lollipop. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you ever seen one? The little square sponge.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, that's not a lollipop. And I would just devastate. I remember being absolutely gutted that it was this bit of sponge that your dad wore. Yeah. But because one of the things that happens with head and neck, particularly in that area, is you lose your taste buds.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, you'll probably lose your sense of taste, your taste buds. Well, I thought, well, you know, I can live with that for a short while. Well, it's not exactly true. What happens is it tastes the worst taste. Everything tastes bitter, sour, off. Mm-hmm. It's horrendous.
I think that's something that I felt my chemotherapy did to me as well. And, you know, it just brings us back to the whole biggest lesson that we learn from going through cancer, which is how important an early diagnosis is, how important it is to know what your normal is. So how, you know, Rob is as normal Rob, or how Arzu is as normal Arzu, because if there's something wrong and we keep ignoring it, it can lead to things escalating. I mean, you potentially could have lost your voice, or in my case, I potentially could have lost my leg. And it's so important to see your doctor, even if it's slightly different to your normal. And, you know, I just want for you to take this opportunity to give a message out to our listeners who have tuned in today, and maybe they know someone who's going through cancer. Maybe they've just been diagnosed, or maybe they've not even been diagnosed yet and potentially could have cancer inside of them and they're not aware of it. So, you know, what would you like to tell our listeners today from your own experiences and lessons that you've learned?
So the thing to do is, and I do this now, is to see the GP, seek medical advice. I mean, we all know whether you've got cancer or not, or had cancer, is that it affects one in two. That's every other person. So if there was, well, if we, in normal circumstances, you and I were sat there talking, it would be one of us. Unfortunately, it's been both of us, but it's that close. And by going to the doctor and not being, oh, I'm a bit embarrassed about it because of where it is or what the problem is, or I don't want to talk about it, there is nobody you are going to see at a hospital or in the GP surgery or anywhere you want to go that has not seen or dealt with what we're dealing with. There can be no embarrassment. There's no need to be embarrassed. And what you've got to do is just say, I don't feel right. This isn't right. That's right. And they'll ask you the questions and you answer honestly, and you'll save yourself. Early diagnosis will save you. I mean, let's be honest about this. If I'd have left it until Easter, I would have died.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And that's the way to look at it. And now I look at life a lot different. I don't feel right, I ring the doctor. If I want to do something, I do it. It refocuses you, but it shouldn't take a personal experience to refocus your mind. It should be listening to what people are saying and advocating and thinking, you know what, we need to do this. I mean, I work, one of the things I want to do at the end of treatment, you'll have done it. Did you do the health and wellbeing event at the end?
You know, no, I actually didn't do it.
No. So they do a health and wellbeing event at the end, and you don't feel healthy, you don't feel well at all, but you have to go to this event to make sure. And it's this sort of, it's probably one of the most life-changing incidents that you're going to experience in your life, as you know, and then it stops.
Yeah.
And then you go, well, what do I do now? What happens next? And no one can answer that.
That's so a whole new journey of its own, you know.
Exactly. And it brings its own concerns and worries. But they have a day, like 9:30 till 3. And you go along and you're all there and they tell you stuff and else. And a lot of this stuff they tell you is what you could have done with knowing 6 months earlier.
Yeah.
So I sort of, being me, said, well, don't we know it now 6 months earlier? Why don't we find this out? And I was talking to Mandy Davis and Matt Millen, who was there doing it at the time. And I work with Mandy on Matt Millen stuff a lot. And she sort of understands my philosophy very well. And Helen and Polly, they all understand that I'm not a can rattler. I just want to get on and make people aware, and please don't go through what I went through. And if you are going through it, we're going to make it as easy as we can.
And I think this podcast is literally, you know, just one of those platforms for which you are sending out that message. You are allowing the people who are listening to know that there is support out there. And there are people like Macmillan support, your Macmillan nurse, and any healthcare professional, your GP, who would do anything to support you. It's just that, you know, courage that you need to gather to go and speak to someone and share your concerns and be vulnerable at the end of the day. And like, you know, just to wrap things up, I want to say that despite your setbacks and all the challenges that you faced and like those moments of hopelessness when you felt all alone, you know, you can survive. And I want our listeners to know that they can also survive. And this is the motto of our podcast. We want people to know that there is light at the end of the tunnel, despite there being, you know, those challenges, those hurdles, things like, you know, radiotherapy, chemotherapy and surgery. It is going to be tough. It's not a walk in the park. It's not easy, but it's all about, you know, just keep swimming, literally. That's something that I stuck by and something that stuck with me. Or be positive. Like, I realized my blood group is be positive during treatment. And then I was like, okay, Arzu, you need to be positive to get through this. Yeah. And literally, just through speaking to you today, it's just been amazing. And it's been so inspiring. I had no idea how difficult your journey was, but just seeing you turn up at every Cancer Champions meeting or attend so many of the other events to raise awareness, it's just amazing and so commendable. And I can say I'm proud to know a fellow cancer survivor like yourself. And, you know, like we mentioned in one of our previous meetings, you had to lose your voice to truly find your voice. And I'm so happy that you were able to tell your story in your voice despite being diagnosed with throat cancer. I mean, it's truly inspirational.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's very kind of you to say so. And I have to say that I am very pleased and proud to be your first guest.
So that brings us to the end of the first episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. We really hope you gained something from Rob's story today and felt inspired. If you have found yourself to experience any of the symptoms that Rob mentioned today for more than 2 to 3 weeks, then we urge you to see your GP as soon as possible. Some of the symptoms of head and neck cancers include changes in the voice, such as persistent hoarseness, difficulty or pain upon swallowing, a persistent cough lasting for more than 3 weeks, shortness of breath, or a lump or swelling in the neck region. For more information on head and neck cancers, please do visit the NHS website. Thank you.